Let us bow our heads in prayer. O God, thou art infinite mystery, manifested in the endless vault of heaven above us, and in the inexhaustibility of human experience within us. We praise thee in the quest for knowledge and understanding that shall make us free and creative persons, grounded in the reality of truth. May the challenge of thy mystery, which has motivated these students and teachers in the quest for learning, remain alive in them and in us, to make ever deeper and richer our common life together. Amen.
Good morning. The Honorable Hubert H. Humphrey is a South Dakotan by birth, but a Minnesotan by inclination. Distinguished student, professor, Antioch Cooperative employer, administrator, cum politician, cum statesman, but above all, determined, articulate, and effective liberal in those things which are important in the cause of mankind. It was with great pleasure that I introduce our commencement speaker for today, the Honorable Hubert H. Humphrey, United States Senator from Minnesota, whose address is entitled, What Can the Individual Do? Senator Humphrey.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dixon. Members of the graduating class, members of the community of Antioch College, and friends and neighbors, and I wouldn't want to forget our faculty, having once been a faculty member of myself, knowing the rigors and the sacrifices of such a profession. It's a beautiful morning. It's so good and so such a happy occasion for me that I'll most likely stray far away from what I had intended to say, but I shall at least remember the title of my address. I want to first comment upon the conciseness and the brevity, we trust at least, of the commencement program. This is a rather unusual experience. I've been at many commencements, and I have waited many a moment for the time that my part would come in the program. This is an exhilarating and, may I say, a very refreshing and rewarding experience. I don't suppose one should generalize from this, though. It's sort of like the English anthropologist who came to our country at the time that we were yet colonies in the early 1700s, and when he returned, he wrote an article for one of the professional journals. It's the age of science and technology. I'm not so sure about it. He wrote an article for one of the professional journals, and he said, on my visit to the colonies, I studied the American Indian. He said, all American Indians walk single file. At least the one I saw did. Now, I came to Antioch. All American commencement exercises are compact. At least the one that I saw is. And having said that, let me commend you on this informal type of commencement and to share in the beauty of this day. What a wonderful, wonderful day. Somebody told me not long ago that at Harvard they'd never had rain and a commencement exercise in over 100 years. And then some wit responded, which only proves that God refuses to soak the rich. And I... I want to disavow any connection with that except to be a reporter. I have enough troubles in Congress without taking on Harvard, at least in this... at least at this juncture in history. Well, I'm sure you know that I'm very pleased to be here. As a matter of fact, to give a speech in the morning, for me, it has to be a pleasing occasion. Congress starts at noon. Anytime in the afternoon, I'm available for speeches. In the morning, however, I must say that I consider it a rare opportunity and quite a challenge. The pleasure of being here comes from a sense of identity with this great college, an identity with its traditions and its purposes. Yes, I have an identity with some of your student body, too. This morning I had breakfast with a very fine young man who's been close to me and to my office and my staff, Mr. Philip Schaefer. And if you haven't heard of him, I'm sure you will, because he... he's a strong Humphrey man. And even more for Antioch. And with a very lovely young lady whose father and mother are very close to the Humphreys, Miss Ellen Rosenberg, and to Mr. and Mrs. Bob Press that were with me. And the last evening, I was met at Dayton by one of your honored faculty members, Professor Sparks. And just to make my political identification clear at this nonpartisan gathering, Mrs. Kleeman was also there, who is well-known, I'm sure, in political circles. I can think of no other community of Americans to which I'd rather express my ideas and some of the challenges that I believe are before us. Now, this pride of being here comes from the sense of honor of being chosen as your commencement speaker. My respect for this college is unlimited. And I come to you not with the superiority of a lecturer, because I possess that not, but rather with the humility of a learner. Last spring, for example, I learned something new from you, and my respect for Antioch College was deepened. I learned that American students can offer to students all over the world an example, and a good example, of active expression of beliefs and responsible involvement in the affairs of our society. Now, I speak specifically of a demonstration that was the subject of considerable controversy then and even now. A demonstration by Antioch students last April in Columbus, your capital city, protesting America's role in the Cuban incident. Now, it doesn't matter whether I agree or disagree with the position the students expressed. In case anybody is interested, I was not for intervention. But let me go on record now with the unequivocal support of their conduct and of their right to demonstrate. I think you'd be interested to know that the leading newspaper in my state, the Minneapolis Morning Tribune, or should I say one of the leading newspapers, I correct the record in my state, commented very favorably upon this particular activity. Not again drawing the value judgment as to who was right or wrong in the profession of beliefs or commitment, but in the manner in which it was done. And I wish therefore to commend the students, and I laud them for using responsibly and actively the freedom which America has as its heritage and which we've taken so much for granted. This student demonstration was certainly not unique. There are lots of student demonstrations, and I want to let you in on it. When I was a student, I was in a goodly number of them. But the attitude and the policy of Antioch College and your distinguished president, Dr. James Dixon, that attitude, that policy are unique and very reassuring. in a period of American history when orthodoxy, when conformity, when a kind of synthetic unity has been the pattern of the day. Therefore, I respectfully praise the two basic principles that Dr. Dixon so eloquently expressed. One is that academic freedom is as much a right of the student as it is of the teacher. And those of us who have been teachers, we worship at the shrine of academic freedom for ourselves. I suggest that we share the blessings, or at least the responsibilities of that freedom. Now, the other principle, and I quote Dr. Dixon, is that it is very important in the process of education for students to involve themselves in matters of social action. End of quote. Thank you, Antioch, and thank you, Dr. Dixon, for giving me a key answer to the question which my remarks of today are addressed. That question is, what can the individual do? How can the individual respond, for example, to President Kennedy's inaugural plea to, quote, ask what you can do for your country? Where is the path of action for the individual American, aware but often overwhelmed by the massive and complex problems of a great nation in a tense world? This whole community of America in which we live is so big, it is so involved, it is so complex, that it almost becomes an impossibility for the expression of individuality. And with the loss of individuality, we have, for all practical purposes, the loss of that which the community is supposed to express, our freedom. So it is right, and I think on every occasion we ought to ask ourselves, what can I do? How do I get mixed up in all of this? How do I become a part of the flow of life instead of just being bumped along with it? I think the answer for every American, and not just the student, is, and I repeat it, become involved, get in it, get with it, consciously, actively, completely, and constantly. Become involved politically. I used to lecture to a few of my students when I taught at McAllister College, a fine private college in St. Paul, Minnesota. I had a number of these good students coming from fine, respectable families, and they'd put their hand up like a shield to keep out of politics. Their parents had taught them that politics was dirty. Politics was something that was to be outside of their life. And as I said to many of them many times, get your bar of political ivory soap and get in and clean it up. If you think it's dirty, do something about it. Either that or shut up. If you're not willing to become involved in the day, in the problems of your day, then don't complain about them. Be soldiers of your democracy. Now, I know it's not enough to advise Americans in these bigger problems of the day just to support foreign and domestic programs. That's generally what happens after a speech. People come up to you and say, well, I'm all excited about that, Senator, but what can I do? And the response too often is, just vote. Or the response is, and that's not a bad idea, by the way. A lot of people don't. And then the response is, well, just support the programs, just talk them up, and of course, pay your taxes. I might add that too many Americans feel that this is the full responsibility of their citizenship. Checkbook citizenship and checkbook diplomacy. Buy your way, pay your way. The curse of our time. It isn't enough just to do that. Now, frankly, such advice is to be too vague for the concrete challenges that face us. We're a pragmatic people, and we want specific answers. I would add a basic and specific plea to the now famous inaugural request of the president. I would say to each of you, and to myself and to others, ask what thousands of your fellow Americans are already doing for their country, for their community, for freedom, and then join their efforts. Now the generalities stop. Examples of individual sacrifice and dedication are endless. I sat all yesterday listening to the testimony of people on the Peace Corps, and I believe that one of your students, one of your graduates, has been selected as a Peace Corpsman, Mr. Ken Newman. I want to congratulate him. I hope that hundreds more from this campus will be selected. I was in my home state last week, and a young man by the name of Charles Aiken was selected. Fine young man. What an experience this will be. And how wonderful it was, may I say, to those on this side, to look out into that hearing room of the Foreign Relations Committee and not see people whose faces were twisted with anger and in there complaining, but rather to see the young people of America, hundreds of them, listening to their witnesses testify as to their desire to do something that is right and proper and needed. Not to talk of war, but to talk of peace. Not to talk of hate, but to talk, if you please, of sharing and doing. I can say to the adults or those who are older, we're talking to all adults today, but permit me to say to those who are in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s, who have a chronic political stomachache over many of our young people, that it was mighty refreshing and mighty reassuring to see hundreds and hundreds of young Americans come to Washington, D.C., not only to testify, but to hear a promise of the future and to be a part of it. Now, there's a young man from my state of Minnesota who volunteered through a private organization 2 years ago to share his agricultural skills and his muscle, his work power, with the people of Southeast Asia. He ducked bullets in a war, and he lost a leg in an accident at Laos. Every much a hero as one who had fought on the battlefield in any war. And when are we going to identify peace patriotism with the same honor that we identify so-called war patriotism? Now that young man, after losing a leg, after being shot at, returned first home to recuperate and then back to the field of his work. And today he's helping the people of that region help themselves to progress. There's a middle-aged couple of modest means who adopted 2 Korean orphans a few years ago. And in a few months, this same couple will bring 4 more Korean orphans, quadruplets, into their physically average but spiritually magnificent home. And there's a 30-year-old doctor who will soon leave the comforts of the United States, coming from a very well-to-do family, to go to work and to heal in a hospital, in a very primitive hospital in the remote hills of Burma. He and his young wife, a trained social worker, do not plan a token period of service either. They have given up their profession at home. They've given up the luxuries of a life that's already built in for them, and they're moving permanently to that area and to that hospital and the people that it serves. There's a young teacher, and again, I use the areas that I know so well from my home state, a liberal arts graduate who had no specialized training and no money. When he was asked, "What am I?" he said, "I'm nothing." Graduate of St. Olaf College, who traveled to Thailand, married after his graduation, he and his wife, with little or no money, little or no material assets, took off and went on a mission to Thailand. They stayed there. And he went into the north part of Thailand, into a leper colony, where there was no help. And he and his wife organized in that colony a hospital, organized crafts, so that today the lepers are self-sustaining. They built their own hospital, equipped their own hospital, and he and his wife have brought to that area doctor, nurse, and modern healing. This young man is home right now at Albert Lea, Minnesota. He never had his name in the paper. He didn't hate anybody.
He hasn't denounced anybody. He hasn't complained. It's mighty difficult to make the news unless you denounce. Now, there's an elderly California businessman and his brother, whom I know well. I'm talking about individual cases that this one citizen knows, and there are hundreds of them, who contributed their valuable bank stock to an isolated town in Italy. They did not contribute a part of that stock. They were like early American patriots who said, "We pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." They didn't go around saying, "We pledge one day a month, 5% of our fortune, and what little honor that we can scare up on some weekend." No, they pledged it all. And this couple, they gave all. They gave it all to the people of that Italian town to rebuild it, to put young men to school. I know a young man in the movie colony of Hollywood who, through his church organization, has started to rebuild a whole civilization in Sardinia, taking what you might call the dregs of the poverty-stricken peasantry, retraining them for agricultural pursuits in modern tech and in modern ways, and buying up land, dividing the land, and doing it on his own, giving everything that he has. Now, there's a community in Maryland which has established a sister city affiliation with a village in the Philippines to share friendship and understanding, and when necessary, help. You ask, what can you do? Well, there's a lot that you can do. Look what's being done. Follow the example. A 5-year-old Filipino boy will be able to walk again because the people of that Maryland community arranged for medical treatment of his crippled legs. And because of that one act, American prestige in that Filipino village is at an all-time high. It has done more good than the Voice of America. It's been worth $100 million, if you wish to put it in dollar terms. One act of kindness, one act of compassion. Now, the individual may reply to these examples, and I'm sure some of you will, and say, "Well, they're impressive." But you may say, "I have no agricultural skills, or I don't have any home to open to orphans, or I'm not a doctor or a teacher." And you may say that you do not own stock, or you have no wealth, or that your community is not affiliated with the sister city overseas, so how does this all apply to me? Again, I offer you a specific suggestion. Here's what you may do. You may write to the American Consul of Voluntary Agencies. You can do it this afternoon. They need you. For a publication which lists 77 voluntary agencies covering every group in America working in the field of technical assistance overseas. They need you. And they're doing great work. You may write to the State Department for a directory listing several hundred private organizations or projects helping people of other lands help themselves to progress. You may write to the American Municipal Association for information and guidance on the Sister City program, or when you go home to your hometown, call on the mayor and say, "Mr. Mayor, has this community affiliated itself with another community? Do we have a sister city? Have we built up a library here that talks about the other parts of the world so that we may become more of what we call a world citizen?" Go to him. Bestir that city council. Be a gadfly. Sting some of these people in their political periphery. Make them come alive. Be good for them. You too. There's a list of 150 cities and towns on record right now with the American Municipal Association, which are waiting for answers to their requests for affiliations in America. But the taxpayer apparently would rather write a check on the 15th of April or the 1st of January than to even go to his mayor and say, "Let's adopt, or let's join with, or let's have a sister city program with a city in Africa or Asia or Latin America," and of all the places we need it today, Latin America above all. Now, I have the addresses, the number, the street, and the city of these organizations, so don't tell me now, "Well, he didn't give me any specifics." Write to me. My name is Humphrey. I'm in Washington. I shall be glad to give them to anyone who seeks them and who asks and who seeks to find out how and where he can best contribute his efforts for his country's goal. And what is that goal? World peace and freedom and social justice. There's a place, there's a project, there's work for each of us. And there's so much that can be done. Today, there are 160 sister city affiliations. There should be 5,000. Today, there are thousands of Americans working voluntarily overseas. We need another 10, 20, 30,000. Now, tomorrow morning. Or do we have to wait to be drafted in this different kind of a war? We need skilled Americans, experienced Americans, but above all, we need motivated Americans, involved Americans, dedicated Americans. You can learn to do this. And not just through the Peace Corps either, even though this is an important development. We need to bring more and many more of the citizens of other lands to this nation to learn the techniques and methods that they need and to teach us about their countries. We need to get off on this mountain and quit looking down on people and get into the valley of opportunity and work with people. We need more exchanges of farmers, of labor organizers, of cooperatives and their officials, of educators, of businessmen, of doctors, of students, of artists, of teachers. Let me give you one project for the state of Ohio, one project for the state of Minnesota. I hear many people say about federal aid to education, I don't want it. I don't want this federal interference. What many of them are really saying is I don't want to pay for it, but I'll accept their own rationalization as to why they don't want it. They say we can do it at the state level, at the local level. All right, then do it. May I suggest to every state in this union a minimum of 50 teachers to be sent well-equipped in the language and the mores and the customs and in the disciplines that are required for modern education. 50 from each of the 50 states, which is 2,500 teachers made available ready, be paid for to the Latin American countries. That's a good project. This is something for governors to work on, state writers to work at instead of talk about. And then they can accept and exchange some teachers from Latin America. But since there's such a desperate shortage of teachers in Latin America, I would make the ratio about 1 to 5. Not because we do not want more of theirs, but because they need help so badly. We need a tremendous increase in individual efforts. And we need this from unions, from business organizations, churches and clubs and trade associations. Let me tell you what the individual can do, what you can do. Go to your own organization. I don't know what it is. We need mobile units, hospitals, mobile clinics. Go to a trucking company and say, why don't you buy a mobile half-track truck that can become a clinic that can go across the deserts? If you can send tanks across the deserts, you can send trucks filled with modern medical care. We need jeeps. This young man that I was telling you of in a leper colony hasn't had a new car in 5 years. He bought the jeep himself out of what little savings he and his wife had. No one has helped him. He needs help. Medical supplies, scholarships, books. Lots of books, good books. Our library program overseas is second rate. I'm being too kind. It's fifth rate. For a first-rate country. Now, some may wonder why a United States senator, elected as an official of the federal government, gets so excited about these non-governmental and voluntary efforts. And the reason is quite simple. My awareness of the limits of government in a free society and the need today to mobilize the total physical and spiritual power of this country. Government in the United States is but a part of our strength. Our government is like the top of an iceberg. It can be seen from afar, very visible. But the real power, the real strength is below in the people and their institutions. This is a major distinction between our free society and the totalitarian state. Their government, the totalitarian, represents and is the total power of the nation. It's everything. And it's able to dominate and control and dictate and organize every resource of its own people. And this continuing contest with totalitarianism, and it will be a continuing one, you'll never live to see the day that it's over. Prepare yourself for that long ordeal and be unafraid. It will be long and arduous and tough. And I say that our government alone cannot win it. And that's why we must learn to mobilize the real power of the nation, the power of the people, the power in each of you. We must learn to mobilize to coordinate our private and our voluntary resources without government dictation or domination. We must let the world know that we do not seek to dominate, but rather that we seek to cooperate. Now, our government can help to direct that power and to coordinate that power. That's what we mean by leadership in a free society. We seek the type of leadership, and it is required, which educates, which persuades and convinces and inspires the people to give the best of themselves. And that leadership must outline in detail our objectives and our goals. It needs to clear away the confusion and the doubt, and it must show every individual how he can fit into the national pattern for progress and freedom. There isn't any reason to ask people to sacrifice if they don't know what they're sacrificing for. And we can't do this only on a policy of negative anti-communism. Let me get this statement straight to you. A foreign policy based strictly on anti-communism is doomed to failure. It's one of the reasons that we're in trouble today. Had we 10 years ago sought to join with the peoples of the world to liberate themselves from their ancient enemies of poverty, of mass misery, of ignorance and sickness, had that been the expressed and the declared and the pursued declaration of our purpose, we would have been long on the way to the eventual victory for freedom that we now cherish so much. And I remind this audience that instead of that, while having stated that as a policy, we made it essentially anti-communist. Anybody that said they were an anti-communist, now don't misunderstand me, I have fought the communist. I consider totalitarianism the worst form of reaction. The reactionaries of the right and of the extreme left. Reaction that denies individuality. But I want to repeat, we need to join the march of the people. And we are faced with the same decision once again, just as we were in 1951 and 50. So in 1961, another decision has to be made in Latin America. Will our efforts in Latin America just be anti-Castro, anti-communist, or will they be pro-people, pro-freedom? That decision will be made in the next few weeks. It's being made now. I think we have to have a policy based on human principles. We must be pro-people and pro-freedom. We must concentrate on our goals, and we must let people know what those goals are. And we must state that our goal is a world at peace and be unafraid to work for it.